We're on the choir sermon. And I've said before that one of the things that we do is measure. You know, you get a measure in the lifestyle of various things. You measure freedom. We get a standard measure, and so that we can measure various things when we do encounter them later on in our life of education. And that's, you do measure freedom, measure love, measure quality in various disciplines and various kinds of expression. And really today you get to measure measure insanity. You really do. You get to see someone come apart. Hopefully within your eyes, if you can use your imagination, and that image, use the eyes of the person that's writing, you allow them to bind your imagination. That's one of the ancient definitions of a poet, is one who has the power to bind your imagination. And it's an interesting one, I think, to keep. If you can see the world through the speaker's eyes, you will see what the world looks like to one who is cracking up. And I think that the irony is that this vision, never so fast, never so much all at one time, is recognizable to ourselves. At least if you've looked, just looking at you, Nancy, into hospitals and what went before and what went after. In all the aspects, not just the hospital, but what led up to it and what follows it. That kind of thing. Anyone who is 18 years old is old enough to know grief and to have experienced grief and loss in all forms, loss of meaning, loss of loved ones, not necessarily by death, but various kinds of loss. And maybe a way of saying that is to be present while the milk and honey turn sour. You know, everyone, that's maybe a good image for loss. While the milk and honey of existence turn sour before our eyes. Well, I wasn't satisfied with yesterday's session for myself, because I felt I was trying to do a bounce from last year's, some notes I had from last year to the notes I had from the year before to new ones that I had, and I always lose a rhythm and a sense I feel like I sound foreign to myself. So I'm going to forget that, and I'm going to just read the right from the book, and then if we miss some things, you can listen to last year's tape. That's one of the difficulties about taping, because if you ever hit a really unusual expression, then you always want to repeat it, and then you kill off the new expression for the next year. There is a good tape in there on Wasteland, and you may want to listen to it afterwards. But let's look at the fire sermon new, and maybe we'll come up with some more things. Let's read through the section, and then we'll look at the questions. See if we've missed some things. But to get a reading and get a hearing of what is said first, to be sure that we've heard the thing again, and then maybe our answers to the questions will need some more qualification or addition or subtraction or whatever. The fire sermon. Well, fire is symbolic of lust and purification. Right there is an irony in the two of the things that fire symbolizes, in that there are differences. The river's tent is broken. The last fingers of leaf clutch and sink into the wet bank. That wouldn't be called a positive image, would it? One that does lift your spirit. The wind crosses the brown land unheard. The wind crosses the brown land unheard. Unheard wind. What would an unheard wind be like? What is that? What's another? Can you paraphrase that?
Breeze.
Breeze? Wind? Breeze?
Well, nothing to go against as you hear it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't whistle through anything.
Yeah, doesn't it? It's a brown land, it's lacking that. Greek students, wind?
Mm-hmm.
Spirit? The spirit crosses the brown land, the dead land, unheard. Remember your Psalm 19. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth forth knowledge. And this without language or sound of any voice. And yet you're instructed. The Spirit instructs us without words, but the Spirit instructs. And the Spirit now is unheard. We can't hear it. We can't hear it giving meaning to what we're seeing. We just see things like the river's tent is broken, and that's a difficult image for me because I'd like to make it a lot of things, but I can't. You know, the river's tent is broken.
John, what kind of images come to your mind with that? Because I couldn't.
With that one?
Yeah.
Christ is talked of as a river. The God exists within the tent of our praise. The tent is torn apart. The rivers, it's a possessive. This tent of our praise, which belongs to river, which is a symbol of life, also can be a symbol of Christ, is broken. Now that works in with the other Christ imagery in the poem. And I think that's what I would like someday to try to chase down through here, because this poem is, if you see in the notes here, people originally didn't see as much Christ imagery in the poem as your notes in this red book have. And Eliot is really, some of the criticism of Eliot is that he, in his own notes, did not make plain enough the how very much Christ had to do with this poem. He does have that one, though, about the road to Emmaus, doesn't he, and the hanged God. That's his footnote. So he gives a clicker there, because we're on a pilgrimage, right, and we're on a road, right, and where's the road? To Emmaus. And what happened before the people got on the road to Emmaus? Christ was crucified. And what was their understanding? Christ, they did not know that Christ had risen. They are living on the road to Emmaus. This is a picture of the way life is on the road to Emmaus. When Christ is only death. And they haven't gone. And in a sense, he goes to a tomb, he goes to a chapel and finds it empty. But he doesn't know still that Christ is risen. He just finds it empty.
And is that also the wind unheard? Is unrecognized?
Well, there. I think it could tie in. I think if you went, you know, it would take a lot of meditation, really, on these texts. On this as a text. You looked at this as a text. By the way, do that. I refer to the books that we're talking about, and I says, well, allow the text here, you know, and do exegesis, you know, on your text. That there are no mistakes in there. That's a very particular box. It's packed with very particular stuff. But my gosh, some of those boxes are deep, and this is a deep trunk, you know, a deep trunk. But that would tie in. I think we only find we do only find, you know, it's speaking as a, what, lay theologian or whatever you, you know, or mountebank or charlatan or whatever I am. You know what those words mean, don't you? Let's see. You know, Christ does live in our praise, and if we're not praising, he's dead to us, and we're dead to him. And something has happened to where the praise has gone out of this man's life. Sort of like your aunt him. Once, and I did want to. You know, but gee, I just can't understand it. I can't get you between my ears. After what I've done and after what I've known, how can there be forgiveness? Instead of, you know, accepting it, praising it, and then he lived, and his power lives, and the Spirit is heard, and so forth. Also, the river's tendon is broken works in the literal phrase because the surface of the river, is going to be broken, even though later he says that there isn't all this junk in the river. He's saying that ironically, that he's down beside the Thames and what's floating in the, it's just all this garbage. And on the river of life, you know, the surface of the river of life is broken by butt ends, you know, garbage, broken things. So that all that, you know, that's what's so amazing. That's why poetry is so frustrating and so amazing, is that it, you know, you could hang in there on those five words. The river's tent is broken. Doesn't mean anything. But in this context, those five words become, you can talk a great deal knowledgeably about it and gain some understanding about a lot of odd things, like theology, your own faith, your own praise or lack of praise in your life, your own trust in God and lack of trust in God in your life. Anyway, river, yeah.
Oh, just one thing, you know, like, then it's feeding, the fingers are feeding, or the water is what is fed, and the fingers of the leaves and that. And the tent could be almost in a sense of a womb type of thing too, that now is no longer feeding?
Well, there's
tent in that sense?
Could be. We're going under it, you know. The dead stuff is going under.
I don't quite understand where you got the eating, the fingers feeding the leaves, feeding into the river, or anything. I don't understand.
Well, I was thinking, why aren't there leaves anymore? The last fingers of leaves, you know, the last growth. That's the kind of image that came to my mind, and I thought, okay, why no more leaves? Why less fingers? Well, you know, everything is sliding into the bank, you know, decaying, slimy, slurch kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So why no longer? Well, if the tent is broken, perhaps that didn't allow that fosters the no growth. Well, I was just going with those two lines, and what John was talking about was bringing in the bottom line, about going under.
Oh, boy. Let's not spend more time on those lines, but those lines, just in this talk, are new to me in ways that, I mean, they're richer to me than ever before. That colon there. See, punctuation is an incredible thing, isn't it? Colon. Well, the wind crosses the brown land unheard. The nymphs are departed. Now, nymph in 1970, we gave a nymphomaniac connotation to nymph. You know, and you call somebody a nymph, and you're not saying that they're, you know, beautiful and sort of pastoral and sort of, you know, surreal. But you're saying they're candy. But here, the nymphs out of myth are no longer at this point in the line. And then the nymphs, he uses the word later and it means something. He's using it ironically. The nymphs have departed. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. And that's the line from Spencer's poem in praise of marriage. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. The river bears no empty bottles, sandwich papers, silk handkerchiefs, cardboard boxes, cigarette ends, or other testimony of summer nights. Now he's saying, that's one of the basic kinds of irony, that where you say what you don't mean, that the river is filled with this, and it does bear testimony of summer nights. But the nymphs are departed. Now the nymphs become modern contemporary young ladies who've been dallying down by the riverside with their friends, the loitering heirs of city directors, the wealthy sons, the people who were in the part of the poem that Ezra Pound told Eliot he should leave out. You know, remember that when I read that? Those men and their friends, the loitering heirs of city directors, departed. They've left no addresses. I mean, they wanted it to be anonymous, and they probably left no names. As at least guys in my class in high school used to go to neighboring towns and tell girls that their names were other things, and they were from other towns. And departed, have left no addresses. That is perhaps a connection to the refugee mentality too. By the waters of Laman I sat down and wept. Did I ask a question about who wrote those lines? Well, those are Eliot's lines, really, because Laman, a lot of things have been done by with the word Laman. I read something that some people had said that the League of Nations was being referred to. That is really stretching it. But Laman is the name of, I think it's Lake Geneva. And that was where Eliot was recuperating from there's a sort of a mental hospital sanatorium there that he was recuperating in. And he had, through the generation of this poem and the working on this poem, he did have a nervous breakdown because of what he was seeing. And by the waters of Laman I sat down and wept is Eliot saying this. Also, you got by the waters of Babylon, you know. And then I told you before, there's a poet's bitch here. Well, it's a man's bitch too. What's the bitch in the, by the waters of Babylon, I sat down and wept. How can a person sing a song to the Lord in a strange land? You know, that's what that Psalm, 137, isn't it? Somebody? Is it?
Yeah.
137. And you know how that Psalm ends, by the way? There's a real Hieronymo's mad again at the end of that. It's the most horrible line in the entire Bible. May the heads, you know, of the children of Babylon be smashed on the paving stones of Babylon. That's the most horrible, horrible image. And this is what the psalmist says. A psalm is what? A song, a poem. A psalmist, a poet. Saying, may we smash the head of the children. What happens in Hieronymo? The man, I think his son is killed, and then he goes and writes a drama in which all the people responsible for the killing, you know, responsible for his sadness are killed. And we're getting some of that in here too, apparently. We've talked about some of these themes before. By the waters of Laman I sat down and wept. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. Sweet Thames, run softly, for I speak not loud or long. But at my back in a cold blast I hear the rattle of bones, the chuckle spread from ear to ear, and here comes the eternal footman. Death. A rat crept softly through the vegetation, dragging its, and here, through the vegetation, here's a live image, right? The rat crept softly through the vegetation, dragging its slimy belly on the bank. You ever seen a river rat? You know, really, you know, it's a dry heave image. You know, see a river rat, you know, especially if you're surprised by it. And here he is sitting down by the river, trying to forget what the river looked like, saying, "Sweet Thames, run softly while I end my, you know, till I end my song. I speak not loud or long, but at my back in a cold blast, I hear the rattle of bones, the chuckle from ear to ear. A rat crept softly." What was it really? A rat crept softly through the vegetation, dragging its slimy belly on the bank. While I was fishing in the dull canal on a winter evening, round behind the gas house, that was another line that made infuriated the people in 1922. What? This mixing of this diction. Out behind a gas house.
What's a gas house?
I think it's just a... No, I think in those days it would be a house with propane in it, because in those days they did have, you know, gas-run things. I think that's that. But they do have motor cars, too, so it might be at a fuel dump down by the river, too. But a gas house, a place where gas is stored. But it's down along the river. What does the river look like now? You know, Minneapolis, you've got Nicollet Island, you've got all the... That's how you know it's winter in Minneapolis, when the first guy dies on Nicollet Island. Freezes to death. The drunks go down there, and they live down there, and then you know it's winter when you read in the paper that it was cold enough that night for the guy to die, to freeze to death. And you know winter's there. While I was fishing in the dull canal on a winter evening around behind the gas house, musing upon the king my father's brother's wreck and on the king my father's death before him. Now that's a reference to Tempest, but what else? Fishing is searching, man. Searching. Poetry is talked of as fishing. You're looking for an answer. You're looking for something positive. You're fishing, your mind fishes and so forth. Fishing air to answer, the poem I did on that, trying to... Fishing air for answer to the silence walking from that each is only one on rotten sticks. So you're trying to come up with some sort of an answer to death. And here this guy is out fishing behind the gas house.
That line was so good for me, because my grandfather, until he died, blamed Roosevelt for killing his brother.
I think the fishing, the image, fishing, you know, while I was fishing in the dull canal, I was looking for something. Not so much for an answer to death, but death is all through this thing. Hurry up, please, it's time. But looking for something, probably looking for life, fishing for something live, and he keeps coming up with broken bottles, and he keeps coming up with, you know, the signs of summer night, along the river.
Well, he does find his lives a rat.
And a rat, yeah. And what does he have to think about here? He's thinking on death here, about the death. But it isn't just the death of a father. Now, his father did die while he was writing this poem, too. And that's a pretty hard thing. At least, especially, I think, maybe for poets, when their dads die, they have a heck of a time. I don't know why that is. I think in many ways, a lot of poets do write for their fathers. That's funny, because I think through some poets that I know, and that in many ways they're writing for their fathers, and in many times that's what I'm doing. To talk, you know, really. But, musing on the king my brother's wreck. And the king my father's death before him. Now the brother's dead and the father's dead, and both were kings. And in a sense, he's a king, and he's gonna die. But his brother king and his father king are dead. And he's musing on this, thinking about this. Well, what does that mean to a Christian? I mean, if Christian said, my father's dead and my brother's dead, who would the father be? And the brother, Christ. And now, how can I live? And now, how can I live? God is dead. Yeah.
I didn't see that when I first read it, but also in biblical Old Testament, fellows that lost their praise, were lost their earthly father and earthly brother.
Mm-hmm.
How? What kind of God is this?
Allows that.
Yeah.
It works that way too. Yeah, it does. It does. That's what is so good. One of the good things about poetry is some of the complaints about poetry, it doesn't express itself clearly.
Yeah, but it refers so well.
You know, it's not trying to express. That's rhetoric. It's trying to refer. You know, it's trying to refer. Suggest very particular things, but not to express one thing. And the irony is that in a really good image or a really good poem, by referring, it expresses a number of things at the same time. And I've told you before, in heaven, I'll say 10 things at the same time. I'll be able to, you know. And I think that's part of poetry that comes from that. You know, I can't, gotta say more than one thing at the same time. Because you can't say what reality is like without saying more than one thing at the same time. You can't. So you pack your language and you put it in a context, and you're always working with context and part, whole and part, and relationship between, so that you know, get as much out of it as you can. And you go look at a whip and talk about poetry, making love, you can talk, you know, whole life, you know, and so forth, by talking about a whip. Or you can try. Look at seagulls and see dogs. But, okay, and all my king, my father's death before him, and we do have the death going through here, and the death of really the Christian faith here in the poem, and that fits there. I think that's justifiable. It's not an interpretation that I've ever heard before. I better quick hurry and write it before somebody else does. White bodies naked on the damp, on the low damp ground, and bones cast in the little low dry garret. Rattled by the rat's foot only, year to year. That's what happens. But at my back, from time to time, I hear, and not the chariot, you know, time's winged chariot anymore, but now in the modern age, we don't hear time's winged chariot. He can't say that anymore. He's got to say the sound, you know, and at my back, from time to time, I hear the sound of horns and motors. Here comes death in a motor car, you know, in a Model T. Which shall bring, you know, as the sound of death brought Marvel and his coy mistress together in the poem, remember, that we read? Then the argument was here, you know, if I had world enough in time, I would love your foot for 100 years, and then I would love, you know, X part of you and Y, X-rated part of you, you know, 30,000 years, but I hear behind me the motor, and I mean, not the motor, the time's winged chariot. And so, you know, let's get, well, there's another poem, gather you rosebuds while you may, you know. And so, in a sense, that winged chariot, time running out, death, is bringing the man and the woman together in that poem. And here today, it's bringing the man and the woman together again. Sweeney. Ape Neck Sweeney, remember? Just the guy who would go on shaving while his mistress is having an epileptic fit on the bed. Sweeney to Mrs. Porter in the spring. And it's moving him too, this rejection of life. And Sweeney is a lust image. I mean, he's really, that's what he's got. And then there's a song. Oh, the moon shone bright on Mrs. Porter and on her daughter. And I suppose Ape Neck Sweeney is going for the daughter too. And they wash their feet in soda water. That's from a song. goofy song, but they wash their feet in soda water. But outside that song, can you think of any other place in literature where you have washing feet? Yeah, that's it. And can you think of any other place? That's only by accident, though, feet are washed in there. No, that's the primary place where that happens in religious things, the washing of the feet, and what it means. And here's a use where, what is it? Absolutely nonsense. There's no meaning.
You mean Scripture's the primary place.
Yeah, Scripture's the primary place. And I think in some other religions, they have that. Funny thing, because feet smell so bad, and they get so dirty. And they're also where we touch the ground, and all sorts of things. And for one person to wash another person's feet is really an ultimate sort of humble sign. I will wash your lowest part. You know? And it's a tremendous thing. It would be a failure of the imagination of men and the Catholicity of the Holy Spirit prior to Christ if some other religion didn't come up with that as a very meaningful image for their religion. But anyway, the moon shone bright on Mrs. Porter and on her daughter. They wash your feet in soda water. And oh, those children's voices singing in the dome. In his own mind, he hears this song and he goes washing feet and this, and he goes, ah. It's just one more image. It's just one more thing that comes through his eyes and ears and so forth, that he can't stand. That he will just as soon die to, you know. That gerontion, and it isn't, you know, it isn't so much that the individual only is the one that adulterates the senses, but the potential of the senses it's almost like the senses are so tuned to be able to pick up just beautiful things. And what we are picking up is this crazy Australian, I think, pop song, you know, and it's all the stuff that the senses, all the ways into the guy's being are dumping garbage in it. And he's having a real problem. And what happens? No, these children's voices singing in the dome. And I talked about that innocent, the children's voices that everybody has within. And sometimes it gives you outrage. And if you kill that child off, you better pray him back to life again. Because that child is what gives you outrage. And sometimes you have to have outrage. If you don't have that child up there who is outraged and shocked, it's hard to have. I it's hard to understand respect of self or other people. Because that child demands respect of other people, I think. And anyway, and oh, those children's voices singing in the dome. You know, oh, I am sometimes sentimental, but not usually. But I remember seeing Sound of Music on TV while we were out, a little part of it, and here, you know, and I, you know, I like movies. I think one of the greatest movies, Requiem for Heavyweights, is a really good movie, you know, and so forth. And I heard those kids singing when they hadn't sung for so long. Remember that scene? And he comes home. And all of a sudden, what's that? And the kids are singing in the room. And he goes in, and he sings. You know, I was hanging on to my chair. You know, oh, gee. You know, you know, just thinking about it. You know, isn't that a beautiful thing? Oh, those children's voices singing in the room. I hadn't made the connection. But, gee, you know, the music came back. You know, that scene alone makes the title okay. I mean, you know, that's the Sound of Music.
And that line's something, too, that gives you the measurement for the other things to be outraged about.
Yeah, it really is. And you can get outraged. You hear the Vienna Boys Choir, and then you go hear, "Not three times on this evening if you love me." You know, or, "I beg your pardon." You know? That one, that's a neat song for cliches. The whole song is a cliche. "I beg your pardon, I never promised you a rose garden. Along with the sunshine, there's got to be a little rain sometime." You know, and the whole song is just is tacked phrases. You know, like, "Well, no, It's stacked cliches, the whole thing. It's crazy. Anyway, twit, 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 jug, 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 so rudely forced. Taroo. Taroo. And there's the rape thing, the nightingale, and all those associations. Allow all those associations that you maybe had before you read the poem, but definitely you have now come flooding in this new context. Huh? Remember the children and the Sibyl, I want to die, and then, you know, and then you get the picture of Christ washing the feet, you know, stumbling, the king that stumbled to his throne, who was not too proud to wash the feet of his disciples. Get that there in your head. The brain is a tremendous thing. And the moon shone bright on Mrs. Porter and on her daughter. They washed their feet in the soda water, going at the same time. And then, oh, those children's voices singing in the dome. And then here's your next song, twit, twit, twit. Jug, 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 jug. And what's been said about it before, coming into your head and so rudely forced. True. And then there's a kind of unreal city. Under the brown fog of a winter noon, Mr. Eugenides, the Smyrna merchant, unshaven with a pocket full of currants, CIF London, documents in sight, asked me in demotic French to luncheon at the Cannon Street Hotel, followed by a weekend at the Metropole. I come up, we're in a world where I can come up to Becky over here and I can say, hey, do you want to go to lunch and then go out for a weekend to, you know, spend a weekend with me down in Vegas? In the same breath. See, that's what's happening here. And you can do it. You know? You can do it. You can go out to Seattle. I don't know Seattle that well. Go to Portland. Don't know it at all. I bet you in 5 minutes, you know, that you could go find a Tiresias and ask him to lunch in a weekend. You know, it's an unreal world. Unreal city under the brown fog of the winter noon. Okay. Mr. Eugenides is asking a girl who Tiresias is speaking, you know, who is both man and woman, and he's the one that takes, sort of absorbs all the characters, and now he's this woman who's being asked, and then he's going to watch this other thing. At the violet hour, when the eyes and back turn upward from the desk, the eyes and back turn upward from the desk, when the human engine waits like a taxi throbbing, waiting. The human engine waits like a taxi throbbing, waiting. That's... I, Tiresias, though blind, throbbing between two lives, old man with wrinkled female breasts, can see at the violet hour, the evening that strives homeward, brings the sailor home from sea. You know, you get these grand themes of Odysseus and so forth. That brings the sailor home from sea, the typist home at tea time, clears her breakfast, lights her stove, and lays out food and tins. They get another artificial thing. It's not a shock. Food and tins is no big deal now, but in 1922 it was still odd. You know, it's like, you know, this is food, TV dinners. Her stove lays out food and tins, out of the window, perilously spread, her drying combinations touched by the sun's last rays. She washed her clothes and she's got this little line across her window, drying out her stuff. She's washed in the sink. Her drying combinations touched by the sun's last rays. She's home now. Come back home from work, and the 9 o'clock bell struck in her morning. Now the day's work is done. She comes home. On the divan are piled at night her bed. She's living probably in one of these little, what's called an efficiency apartment, which we all know is being, you know, unsuitable housing for man or beast. At night her bed, stockings, slippers, camisoles, and stays. I, Tiresias, old man with wrinkled dugs, perceived the scene and foretold the rest. Looks at the scene, knows what's going to happen. Breast. Perceived the scene and foretold the rest. I too awaited the expected guest. I am this. This brother and sister to all quality is something that is not only Tiresias's, is it? I mean, this is... I too awaited the butcher's knife. I too awaited the bomb. I too awaited these things. And here in Tiresias, he gets to see this picture, at least an image of what things could be, that there could be this, in a positive way, there could be this, I am you. And here in Tiresias, he says, I too awaited the guest. The young man carbuncular arrives, a small house agent's clerk with one bold stare. One of the low on whom assurance sits is a silk hat on a Bradford millionaire. That image is a... can you relate with that?
Is that a carbuncular? To me, there's two definitions for that.
Mm-hmm.
A carbuncular can be like a jewel.
Yeah. Is it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what it means here. Yeah, yeah. But carbuncles and so forth, the carbuncular young man. Huh?
Jewel of a person?
No. Irony, yeah.
In carbuncular, though, that's red and inflamed. That adjective is red and inflamed.
That's a nice one for him, because that's... you know, this is a fire sermon. That's a good word, you know. But I think it's to be, in a sense, he wants to create an ugly picture, not because, you know, the guy's so ugly, but what's going to happen is ugly. And yet, you know, and yet this fellow, the young man carbuncular, that's good. That is, you'll hear that phrase again and again and again. You want to call somebody something, you say, yeah, you're a young man carbuncular. A small house agent's clerk with one bold stare, his whole possession is one bold stare. Cool, cocky, arrogant. He's got that. One of the low on whom assurance sits is a silk hat upon a Bradford millionaire. One of the low... people who is so self-assured, you know, as if he were a king, and what's being talked of is not invincible poise of being beggars made kings. But okay, do you relate to that? I do. I mean, I've looked in the mirror and seen that guy lots of times, you know, through high school. Through college.
High school, and you think, that assurance comes from you don't have anywhere to go if you fail. You're at the bottom.
Yeah, and you don't know any. You know, you don't know anything, and in a sense, you have no measure, and so you measure yourself. You know, big. The thing is that lots of times, yeah, it's a sophomore. That's a good image. It's a sophomoric thing. And I'm not just laying this on guys either, but one of the low on whom assurance sits is a silk hat on a Bradford millionaire. The time is now propitious, as he guesses. The meal is ended. She is bored and tired. Propitious is a good time. Is that a good time? I mean, apparently we're going to have a seduction or a love here. Is it somebody being bored and tired? Bored, perhaps, but tired? Is that a good time to make love? No, terrible. But he figures and he looks and he says, time is now propitious. As he guesses, time to move in. The meal is ended. Well, that would create difficulty. She is bored and tired. He endeavors to engage her in caresses, which still are unreproved if undesired. I mean, she's just kind of standing there. And endeavors to engage, and this engagement is a good word. One of my favorite words is engage. It's gears engage, you know. An image and an idea. engage, they come together and lock. Engage is really nice. Before, you know, engaging the transmission, you know, there's nothing happens, and then, and away you go. Endeavors to engage her in caresses, which still are unreproved, if undesired, and there won't be an engagement here. Unreproved, if undesired. Flushed and decided, he assaults at once. Exploring hands encounter no defense. His vanity requires no response. Now that line everyone can wear. With shame. You know? And we got to remember that one of the biggest signs of damnation in the whole Old Testament is when the people has forgotten how to blush. The people has forgotten how to blush. And to remember how to blush. And why to blush. And that tremendous huge reality that where blushes exist. It's something that life enrichment is about, too. His vanity requires no response. He makes a welcome of indifference. Actually, makes a welcome of indifference. Doesn't even really want anyone to intrude on his idea of what's happening. Makes you welcome to indifference. The person there doesn't matter really at all. And I, Tiresias, have foresuffered all, enacted on this same Devetter ban, or divan or bed. I, who have sat by Thebes below the wall and walked among the lowest of the dead, and bestows one final patronizing kiss and gropes his way, finding the stairs unlit. I have gone through this all before. I have suffered this all before. In a sense, when he is all both man and woman, and then also he's a very positive image too, is because when someone else suffers, you suffer, and then that's the image of Christ suffered everything at once. See, you've got Tiresias in a sense doing this here. Christ has gone through, Christ cracked up before I did. Christ had cancer before my grandmother. And that makes a difference. One final patronizing kiss and gropes his way, finding the stairs unlit. Yeah. I don't know classical literature. Well enough there. Yeah, it'd be a great battle, and it would either, in this context, it couldn't be just death, I don't think.
Isn't Thebes where this is the girl who wants to go back and bury her?
Antigone?
I think.
Is it Thebes?
Yeah, I think so. One thing with geography on that too is, didn't he just have city walls, and he would be on the outside there, above, out and below the wall, but that was the fortification.
Oh, something else on that is that you stone people to death. I mean, you kill people outside the wall, and that probably is something that's being referred to here. I have seen other crucifixions, I mean other deaths, other killings like this. But then the incredible irony, you know, that he bestows one final patronizing kiss and then gropes his, you could see some guy trying to be cool, you know, he goes in, he thinks he's done a seduction. Well, that it's a real question whether you can even call that a seduction. You know, seduction lives on that fair field of maybe. There's no maybe here. There's no maybe here.
There's no persuasion.
No. But then he's thinking he's quite cool, satisfied with himself and so forth, and then thank God at least he stumbles on his way out, cool exit out the door. patronizing kiss, and then gropes his way, finding the stairs unlit. And then you also get in as Tiresias is that man too. I mean, he goes through that too and is blind. And the irony is that Tiresias sees more, knows more than anyone else, and the other people who are not supposed to be blind are blind. Tiresias, who is blind, sees everything. But the people, these people who are have their eyes, do not see.
Can this fellow see into the future?
That was the compensation that Tiresias was supposed to have gotten for having his sight taken away by Juno.
Like in Dante, people in hell had great powers of seeing the future, but when it arrived, when the time came, they forgot all.
Yeah, they got the future, but they couldn't get the present. Exactly.
All they went through, in thinking about the future, it just wasn't there in their head when they went through the deed.
They only had the future, they didn't have the present.
Yeah.
Right. Tiresias gets to...
Does he have it all then, the past too?
Yeah, I think so. And he really sees, he sees all, even though he's blind. And he's a prophet, in a sense. And here, that those who have eyes to see do not see. And those who are blind are given sight. And that's Bible too, and that goes into this, why, one of the reasons why Tiresias is used here. Okay. So he's this punk, you know. He's a punk. And Tiresias has said he's seen this kind of, say, slaughter or killing of persons or just plain not even touching of persons before, this travesty before. But what happens with her? She turns and looks a moment in the glass. He thinks there's been a seduction. There has been intercourse. She turns a moment in the glass, hardly aware of her departed lover. Her brain allows one half-formed thought to pass. Well, now that's done, and I'm glad it's over. You know, that's done. Is this the human engine that waits throbbing like a taxi? You know, for someone to enter it? No.
Well, if it's a machine, then it...
In a machine, yeah.
She would be
as a machine, and you get that image down below. Yeah. But the way you're leaning back, you know, at the point where that line comes, like the human engine waits, like a taxi, you know, throbbing and so forth, you get a different sort of expectancy, you know, there. And we get what was really meant in this one, as he comes back with the gramophone business. But she turns and looks a moment in the glass, hardly aware of her departed lover. Her brain allows one half-formed thought to pass. What hit me? Well, now that's done. I'm glad it's over. Thought I felt something. Then when lovely woman stoops to folly and paces about her room again alone, she smooths her hair with automatic hand and puts a record on the gramophone. And those are some of the stick-in-the-mind lines that there are, too. In Goldsmith's play, Vicar, is it play or the book, Vicar Wakefield? But anyway, a woman is seduced and she goes, and the only thing to do is to go kill herself. For shame. And goes and kills herself. Here, the response to the seduction, and she, with this, this comes right out of the Goldsmith's lines before. When lovely woman stoops to folly and paces about her room again alone, she smooths her hair with automatic hand and puts a record on the gramophone. Nothing happens. Then, this music crept by me upon the waters and along the strand up Queen Victoria Street. Oh, city, city, I can sometimes hear, beside a public bar in Lower Thames Street, the pleasant whining of a mandolin and a clatter and clatter from me within, where fishermen lounge at noon, where the walls of Magnus Martyr hold inexplicable splendor of Ionian white and gold. There's a real contrast, I guess, at that place on the Thames, where on one side you have this beautiful cathedral, this beautiful architecture, and on the other side you've got the sort of the Bowery on the other side in London. This contrast. You've got the gas house on one side and the cathedral on the other. And he's on the gas house side of the river. The river sweats oil and tar The barges drift with the turning tide, red sails wide to leeward swing on the heavy spar. The barges wash drifting logs down Greenwich Reach past the Isle of Dogs, Wailele, Leal, Wailala, whatever. Elizabeth and Leicester beating oars, the stern was formed, the gilded shell red and gold, the brisk swell rippling both shores, southwest wind carried downstream, the peal of bells, white towers. Grams and dusty trees, Highbury bore me, Richard and Cude undid me, by Richmond I raised my knees, supine upon the floor of a narrow canoe. My feet are at Moorgate and my heart under my feet. After the event, he wept. He promised a new start. I made no comment. What should I resent? In Margate Sands, I can connect nothing with nothing. The broken fingernails of dirty hands. My people, humble people who expect nothing. Well, who's talking here? I think I asked a question on that. And that I keep thinking that almost because my people, humble people who expect nothing, I keep wanting to say that Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth is talking here. And yet I just don't like to buy that either.
Who are Highbury at Highbury and Richmond and Kew? I don't. Is that in the footnote?
There is a footnote on that. That's from a line of somebody else.
Are those all seduction things right there?
This one is.
The rich when I raised my knees, the bore me and the undid me, are those references?
That's Purgatory again. Looks like Dante, Purgatory. Remember me who am Pia. Sienna made me, Maremma unmade me. And referring to, that sounds like cities. And here you've got Highbury bore me, Richmond and Kew undid me. And there are places along the river, I believe, as I remember now. Places along the river as they're going down the river. Trams and dusty trees. Highbury bore me, Richmond and Kew undid me. By Richmond, they're out in the boat. By Richmond, I raised my knees, lying on the floor in a narrow canoe. You know. My feet are at Moorgate and my heart under my feet. After the event, he wept. He promised a new start. I made no comment. What should I resent? Here's another response to love, a lovemaking. He at least cried. And she says, what should I resent? Again, talking about respecting, you lose respect for yourself. You know, you don't think God respects you in ways, and you can't respect yourself, but you lose that. You don't respect other people either. And then what should you resent? Who are you to resent anything anybody wants to do to you? And there are times in everybody's life where you feel that way. You know, who am I to resent, you know, somebody treating me as less than a human being? And less than a person. You really, that is a question. Or is it? Has it been in your heads? And have you ever spent, I mean, that's like, well, who am I to be the only guy in school that does X? Or who am I to be the only guy that does this? Or who am I to be the only one to say no thank you as the pipe is passed? I mean, after all, it's all small stuff. Why should I resent anything? Why should I? Hmm? Yeah, that's a little different. That's a little different, but you sure feel that way. I mean, that's part of the respect of self, and where you give up respecting yourself, and then actually you become less respectable. Then your ideas do become less worthy of being, you know, heard. But you respect yourself and you respect your ability, then you really try to come up with questions and you spit them out and you say them. And then if you do that and somebody, you know, lands on you, then you
you do have a right to say, hey, wait a minute, I do resent that. You know, I do resent that. That's what you should be. Well, here you're in a world where, you know, a world where there's, without really, the values have died. And so what do you resent? If everything's relative, you can't resent anything, can you? You can't resent anything in a world where there are relative values. Now, what do you resent that? I mean, and that's the kind of world that this is, the wasteland is, and it gets scary when you start to see so many connections to our contemporary age. On Margaret Sands, I can connect nothing with nothing. Nothing can connect. Here we are in a program, you know, dedicated to making connections. And I can connect nothing with nothing. I just can't connect anything. I can't make anything. Then just another ugly image. Broken fingernails, a dirty hand. My people, and I think there's almost like another voice slipping in here. My people, humble people who expect nothing. You know, and that's something that has hurt me lots of times when I think of students I've had in the past and so forth, and that, my God, they don't expect nothing. They don't really want anything, you know. I could pour my guts out in some of those classes I know last year in the public school. And then I could do something that I could do with my left hand without even thinking about it, and that's fine. There's no difference. You know? I mean, oh, gee, we get to do questions. Good. You know, but not to listen. I mean, and that feeling that my humble people expect nothing, and the sadness of that. Expect, you know? I told my first class, you know, I wanted to raise the quality of men's dreams. And the size of them.
John, why couldn't that go the opposite way? Kind of like running through the forest being and running stupid. Like you're running back to my people, humble people who expect nothing from me anyway. They don't expect anything from me, so therefore I can give them what I want to be. I don't have to connect things together, I don't have to be anything, I don't have and go back down to the lower class people where I came from. That's what I got reading this, and that was kind of one of the most important parts of the poem for me, other than I got out of it. I went pretty much the opposite way, that it's like running through the forest screaming. They don't want anything from me, I'm going to go back there.
As a response to that statement, in your own life, that could be a response. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
I've wanted to be a pioneer, but I can't. You know, I wanted to be stupid, but I'm not. I wanted to think that my calling wasn't to be, you know, one of the struggling through ideas, but it is, and it's not just mine. As I say, you guys, that's your calling too. Huh? Gotcha. It's your calling. I mean, it's too late. You know, there might be somebody out there who isn't going to have to be a student for the rest of their life and contemplative, reflective. But I happen to be talking to a number of people, every one of which is someone like that. Theoretically, there are people who don't have to, but we don't have that anymore, you know? Okay. I would kind of want to do that, but I can't do that. I can't say that because of Elizabeth and Leicester beating oars, and the stern was formed, and there is this scene where Elizabeth and Leicester are out there, and he did want to marry her, mm-hmm. And it does say the humble people.
But these three, it says. The song of the three tamed daughters begins at 266 and winds 292 to 306 inclusive. They speak in tune.
Yeah.
You don't think that's right?
Unless you include you know, I'm in a trouble. I know that the river sirens are singing the first up to 290, 291. I know that. If you're going to include Elizabeth on the river, I can start to think about calling her one of the sirens, the river sirens. But I have real difficulty there, and I don't think in this passage, as in others, I don't think I have to be able to nail it down and say, who is it saying this? But
who are the three kings, just in case that is who?
Well, I think, isn't it in myth that there are three spirits, three daughters of the river?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Isn't that it? Three spirits of the river? I think that's what the note says. Is it?
Not 9 minutes, but this is a different.
Yeah. I think it does.
It refers to the Rhine daughters.
Yeah, the Rhine daughters, and then he's using it to be river spirits of the Thames.
Okay.
And that note says mourning a loss, and I guess I have trouble there too. I can see that the river is no longer what it was, and it is aching because it isn't. It itself is no longer what it was because the river sweats oil and tar and so forth. But the last one, it's in quotations, separated from the part that isn't in quotations. There's a more specific speaker than just the river daughters. And also, the irony there is that there is nothing that is known to be lost. What should I resent? I see another voice coming in on the last stanza there that's in quotations, because you go from what should I resent to if there's anything there, the loss is in that last little stanza, isn't it? The loss of a world of meaning where things do connect, where people do expect things of themselves and of others. In a world of meaning. And so there's a loss there, world of meaning. But it isn't exactly the same voice that was just about, you know, the voices change. The voices of the poems, the voices in the poems shift and go together. And I think here is one of the places, and actually of one of the most confusing places in the poem is this section right here. And it continues down with La La to Carthage, then I came burning, 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 O Lord, thou pluckest me out, O Lord, thou pluckest burning. That's supposed to be St. Augustine talking about the, you know, that the Lord will pluck him out of the sensual fire, you know, that he's burning up in, pluck him out of that, purifying, like so. And well, okay, but there isn't just not enough right there in that passage to make me feel like I can say that I know what's going on. I think the footnote jams St. Augustine and Buddha, the Eastern and the Western tradition, together in those lines. But if the footnote didn't tell me, you know, I really can't get it from the context. Where the other footnotes you can get from the context. You don't have to have them. But here I really don't know what he's doing there. The next piece. Well, we were going to look. Do you want to look at the questions? Or do you want to go on to this next thing? We're not going to get to what the thunder said today. Do you want to go on and then if we have a few minutes, then look at the questions again? Okay, death by water. Weird. Weird passage of the poem. You know, a strange passage. Phlebas the Phoenician. A fortnight dead, forgot the cry of gulls, the deep sea swell, and the profit and loss. One thing that did mean in that world was profit and loss, trade, that seemed to me, even in the wasteland, seemed to be important. Now the death, you know, the death comes, and there is a forgetting of profit and loss. A loss is thought not in terms of meaning, but just bucks. I lost bucks. A current under the sea picked his bones and whispers, he's dead now. As he rose and fell, he passed the stages of his age and youth, entering the whirlpool. I think we talked a little about this once, didn't we? About that whirlpool, if indeed get the image of that, if you rise and fall, passing the stages of his age and youth, entering the whirlpool. You know, it's your life is this downward, you know, this downward motion. That your stage, the stage, all the stages, even your risings are falling. You know, if you have entered into the whirlpool. Gentile or Jew, O you who turn the wheel and look to windward. Here's a wind again coming all across the brown land, but the guy's turning to it. Gentile or Jew, O you who turn the wheel to look and look to windward, consider Phlebas, who was once as handsome and tall as you, and is now dead. Well, my goodness, what an odd passage. Is that, did that strike you as one of the odder? Well, what's that doing there? It did me. I have a lot of difficulty with it. It is, as I said before, it's a poem that Eliot wrote in French, and before he wrote this, and then when he wrote this, he translated this into English and put it in the poem and as Death by Water.
You're talking about the wind as spirit, then the last two lines would be kind of like saying, you know, it would be a very anti-Christian couple of lines saying that looking to the spirit is going to show you nothing. Maybe that Phlebas was once as handsome and tall, or was once as spiritual or as ever as you hoped to be, but now he's dead, so it didn't do any good on for you.
Well, I don't know. If you say, oh, you who turn the wheel, oh, you who are in control of your life, oh, you who are in control of your life and are the captain of your ship, look to windward. Look into the wind. Look into it. Look into inspiration. Look into to try to hear the Spirit. You are going to confront death, your mortality. Consider Phlebas, who was once handsome and tall as you, my reader. You know, here's that my reader again. He's addressing direct to you. And you do, you know, coming to terms with death, outside of Christianity, that's about the only thing you've got going. That's the biggest game in town, man. But you can trace back what people do to coming to terms with death in some way. It's one of the biggest problems. Biggest problem is, and I heard just recently, I don't know where, but the biggest problem is that the dragonfly. You ever watched a dragonfly? Incredible complexity in that, say, dragonfly. And that's just one example. Beauty, complexity, you know, four wings, the whole bit. Zoom, tremendous aerial thing. All that fantastic thing is going to be dead in a, you know, how many days? Now, that's one of the biggest problems man has, is that the dragonfly dies. Among other things. And through that question, one comes up, what's the meaning of it? It comes through that kind of question, doesn't it? And so, in the Spirit, the Holy Spirit certainly addresses itself to that, you know, inspiration. And so that is the central, I think that the central problem, at least one of the central problems, if not the central problem, that that people have, and it'd be good to look at it and not try to, and not to know it, because that's one of the things, the big walls that you're going to walk into. And so think about it. And that's something that he's saying. Gentile or Jew? Where's that come from? Gentile or Jew? It makes no difference, Gentile or Jew? What?
He's not only talking about looking death in the face, but like where you store your treasures. You know, Phoenicians were businessmen.
Mm-hmm.
And when you turn your wheel, you'll be able to look under to go into business. Consider that what you're storing up is not going to last.
Mm-hmm. That's a good thing. And the idea of the loss being the profit and loss business, that your understanding of loss really in your life is money, or trade is screwed up. Somehow you invested X and you only got Y and so forth. And that's your concept of loss is that. And not as Anthony Burgess says, the meaning of life stems from the loss of it. I'll have to get that quote. But the meaning of life, is directly related to loss. And I hadn't really realized how close that statement was to this particular passage here. Everything in life, all meaning is related to loss. Well, now, Kathy, you were going to say something about what Liz said.
Well, what she said sounded like a very Christian thing, saying that you should be thinking about death and realizing that physical things, storing up physical things, that kind of sounds like the kingdom of the Bible. And I thought that Eliot wasn't a Christian anymore. So would that be right?
So it would be right up to the point of storing up things in heaven, really. Mm-hmm. Amen? I mean, he definitely is speaking out of the Christian tradition. Eliot is writing this. His mother was very big in it, in Anglican thing. The school, by the way, the school that, now, Rich went to Washington? No.
Yes.
Washington University. And that school, the name of that school was going to be Eliot University. Because T.S. Eliot's grandfather was the guy who started the whole thing, that university, almost single-handedly kind of thing. And they were going to call it Eliot, but family humility decided to call it Washington University. Mm-hmm. But that's down in St. Louis. But anyway, and his mother was very religious, and he was very well schooled schooled in Christianity. And you can't get away from this to say that, you've stored up treasures, and now what have you got? Currents in your pocket. And I don't mean berries, I mean sea currents. You're drowned and that's it for this person. That this person was one who, isn't in heaven. This is one who is dead.